Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this special edition of Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Regular listeners will know that we tend to cover the latest new releases that are out in the cinema. And as cinemas are currently not open for business, we are looking elsewhere for our stories and things in the domain of cinema to discuss. So this week we're looking at a topic that is a little bit strange, and I think this episode might be a bit different for people who have maybe never tuned in before, but you know, we're using this opportunity to try out some new things, and we're going to see how they go. The theme of this episode, I guess, a general theme, is on the strange and bizarre and intriguing world of movie premieres. And I think what the plan is for this edition is to explore that world in a slightly roundabout way, through a little personal anecdote. I have a special guest on this podcast who is a first time guest, Mr. Tom Lamont. Welcome.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
Tom, how do we know each other?
Well, we're old friends. We went to secondary school together. I guess I would date our friendship back to the mid-90s, 93, 94, when we were kind of 11-year-old boys who had absolutely no idea how to communicate with each other emotionally, but who formed a kind of bond over pop culture, basically. The Simpsons and Mortal Kombat and Red Dwarf and movies and films. That's about right, yeah?
Oh, I totally agree, yes. I mean, one thing to add, actually, which this might sound a little bit contrived, but you'll see why I'm mentioning it later on, is that I seem to recall that when we were at our secondary school, we'd kind of both paired off with other friends and then formed a little kind of gang of four, and then me and you kind of paired off, and then the other two guys paired off. So we did a little kind of partner swapping deal.
Yeah, we went full John Updike at the age of 11.
We
wife swapped.
Exactly.
Wow, we're going there. Okay, I'm
keeping it all anonymous, there's a reason I've mentioned that, and I'll come to it later. But I seem to recall that one of the reasons why we became friends was, and maybe this would help in kind of dating our friendship as well, is because we were both big fans of the film Demolition Man.
Huge, huge fans. Yeah. I mean, Snipes in general, I would say.
Yes, yes.
But there was just like total agreement on the apex of Snipes and Sly's career being Demolition Man.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were in mutual agreement at a certain period. I must say my interest in the film has lapsed a little bit, but I think we both agreed that it was the greatest film ever made at a juncture in time early in our relationship.
Do you know what's really insane is that the future as depicted in Demolition Man is now the deep past. I mean, like, you know, we're a good 10 years on from that utopia. They didn't get everything right, I'm gonna say, in their prediction of the future.
I think to two kind of young schoolboys, sort of pre-teen almost, what we were able to see in that film was literally mind-blowing, I would say.
Yeah.
And I think if nothing else, it's a film that was made for long-term friendships to be forged over.
I like to think we weren't the only ones whose founding text was Demolition Man.
No, but it's held us in good stead, I think, and we're kind of coming up to the we're coming almost up to the 30-year mark, which is pretty daunting to even say it out loud. Yeah. But you know, there you go, I just said it. We were friends for a long time, and I think one of the things that we had in common was a love of film, and I think we would as most people did that age, I would come to your house and we'd go to various other people's houses and rent movies and watch them.
I remember we watched Basic Instinct. Do you remember this? We watched Basic Instinct in your front room, and my most vivid memory of this is that your dad came in and he wanted to watch the O.J. Simpson trial on the other channel, and we were right at the big, you know, the muff scene. It was like, it was right there.
And so when was O.J.? I can't recall the
date. Mid to late 90s.
Yes, right. Wow. Yeah, no, my memory is maybe less banal, but more banal than that. I remember that we rented a film after spending a lot of time in the video shop near to your house in Palmer's Green.
Video Fair. Video Fair.
Yeah. Next to Smoker's Paradise, was it?
Yeah. Which was in turn next to what? Do you remember?
Oh God, no! That's the
Cancer Research.
Of course, yeah, yes, of course, yeah. There was a cancer research shop and a shop called Smoker's Paradise next door to each other, which was the subject of many a Time Out London caption competition. or you wouldn't believe it, but we rented the film Malice, and I think we watched it with your mother and father. So it was a kind of like family thing. I don't have any memory of that film, to be honest. But I definitely remember that your mother really liked it.
Malice?
Yeah, the film Malice.
I mean, Joanna Lamont, you really like Malice?
Yes, okay. I think you can maybe check up with her.
I'm going to say that she would. There isn't a lot of like crossover between my mum's taste and the kind of films we were renting at the time. You know, she's not your natural Demolition Man sort of...
Demolition Woman.
She's like a Demolition Woman, but I'm glad we accidentally chose one once that did it for her.
So, in case any listeners are thinking this is a kind of wildly indulgent,
whimsical
two guys remembering their youth, I think we should maybe we'll start to kind of get to the meat of the issue now, which is this broader subject of premieres. And I guess before we go into the main crux of this episode, I guess in terms of your place in the sort of journalism industry and the sort of stories you cover, I would say that you don't tend to necessarily get that much, the world of world premieres doesn't really come into your kind of purview.
No, that was very daintily put and delicate. No, it doesn't. No, I'm not front. I'm not seat A1 at the at all the hot ticket shows. No.
Hmm. I didn't mean that. I didn't mean that as an insult. By the way, I just meant if anything, it's a high compliment.
I've been to a few prems. I've got some stories to tell about prems.
Well, could you possibly just to sort of give us some background here? Could you maybe citing some examples? Give us a little example of like what a kind of average premiere is. Like as an attendee, what do you do when you go to these premieres?
Well, I mean, it's taken me quite a long time to work out what premieres are, what they're for, like why are they as seedy as they are, like why are they as sort of unglamorous as they are. But that's been like a 20-year journey. What did you think the movie premiere was, because I sort of got it all wrong. Well, I'm wondering what you thought it was.
I guess from a distance, from a disconnect, I definitely had this concept of it as being like, you know, the big moment where the public at large were able to connect with this film. Actually, you know what? That's not true at all. I don't know what I thought of it. That's what I think of it now, because I know that's what it is. But I'm not sure I even thought of it that much. I think my only connection with premieres were like seeing pictures, like seeing paparazzi shots in papers of people doing the red carpet, and I'm not sure I even knew that they would even that watching the film was part of the premiere. I thought it was just a kind of celebration with the people in the film.
We would see the kind of the morning after paparazzi shot in the paper, and I sort of always assumed that that was, you know, a tiny little postage stamp size piece of the puzzle. And the larger thing about premieres was they were these kind of coming out parties for the movie. They were like, it was like a celebration for the cast and the crew, and like, you know, and just the public were given this little window into it via the red carpet and the paps, and you know, and a little bit of, you know, Gordon Smart or the 3 AM girls writing about it in the papers the next day. My history of, you know, sporadically attending premieres has slowly sort of torn away that illusion, and sort of left me with the really sort of fairly bleak understanding that the entire point of the premiere is to get that column inch from Gordon Smart or the 3 AM girls, to get the paps out, and that everything else, everyone else sort of summoned to this thing, the crowds and the fans and what crew show up and what cast are there, is all just in the service of a sort of tiny bit of kind of tacky paper coverage, right? I mean, that's it. That's the whole point of the premiere.
Yeah, I think because like the critics would have seen the film earlier maybe, and they would have done, you know, that there would be a junket where they could have done all their interviews and stuff. So there'll be no real function for sort of journalists to be interested in that world. So like, yeah, and at the same time, you wouldn't take like getting sort of proper serious analytical film coverage into the tabloids. You know, that wasn't the route you could take, unless you were certain. I mean, you know, there were obviously certain films that the tabloids would be more interested in, like, you know, the All Saints film, for instance. which is just, I don't know why that's popped
what was
to mind,
that called?
Oh God, I can't even remember.
It was quite Guy Ritchie-ish, wasn't it?
It was one word.
Yeah, like take it or something. Well, you know, yeah, or
shove it.
steal me. It was really sort of, it was like Snatch, but it wasn't Snatch.
Yeah. But let's not look it up, because I think it's better that we don't know.
It's better we don't know. Well, the quintessential. So I was just going to say that, you know, the quintessential premiere of our youth, of our childhood, was Four Weddings and a Funeral. And this is when, like, Liz Hurley wears a dress and they get, you know, days if not weeks worth of coverage out of it. And that is like, that was like the textbook kind of way you do it. You kind of, you get everyone writing about your movie that they haven't seen by, you know, the vehicle of middling celebrity.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I thought about premieres when I was young, maybe, I don't know if you agree or not, but like, I definitely thought that the very idea that I would ever go to one of these or attend one of these would be completely, I thought this was,
it was
like
dreamland.
An elite function, basically.
Yeah, oh yeah, like, I mean, you might be able to like dress as a waiter or a bodyguard and like sneak in, you know, in some unfathomable sort of fantasy, but no way were you going to one of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if I knew about like the idea of like prize winners getting to go along, but like even if there was some kind of like competition, the idea that in my mind it would be so difficult to win that it wouldn't even be worth entering, because the prize of going to a premiere would be of such high value.
It'd be the golden ticket in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Everyone would be trying to get the ticket off you on the way there. It would just be bedlam.
Like if Charlie had got all the golden tickets,
yeah.
And like binned nine of them.
You know, in Saving Mr. Banks, the film they made about the Mary Poppins, making Mary Poppins. There's a scene where they, you know, the premiere of that is like dancing penguins, there's, you know, there's chorus girls, there's like fire eaters, and that is just, that would have been the case. That's what I thought it was going to be like outside, but also inside. You know, you're sitting down and there's just going to be like acrobats and, you know, tears and, yeah, the movie would be, yeah.
Have you ever been to a premiere like that? Because I think I have been, I remember going to the premiere for Kong Skull Island. Ooh. Do you remember that film?
I haven't seen it.
It was the King Kong sequel with Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston, which I really, really didn't like at all.
I, at the time,
liked those guys, and you know, I wished them well. So I did want to like it, but it was they had a big kind of. What they'd done is outside the View. The Cine World, which used to be called the Empire. They had built a kind of fiberglass walkway thing that was not dissimilar to a kind of. Imagine if you were like at a theme park and you were queuing up to go on a ride for. Kong Skull Island, and you know it was all this kind of, you know, stuff from the film, and it was, you know, all these props and things, and there was a big wall that you could have your picture taken in front of, and you know there was uplighters and floodlights and all this kind of stuff, and you know, you had Rick Edwards and Edith Bowman there doing their thing, and you know, it did feel like, you know, there were like throngs gathered looking at what this kind of site is, and you know what, and all the kind of the amazing stars that were kind of going into this premiere, and then you get inside and it was literally like normal cinema, like you know, there was you
the
know,
popcorn nothing. Smell the wet
yeah,
carpet
it was yeah. It was nothing more, and so there is a kind of illusion element to it as well, I think.
But you mentioned Edith Bowman doing her thing, and that's the other, like, definitely the weirdest part of premieres by a long distance, is that they tell you as sort of Joe Public to get there at a certain time, and you excitedly take your seat, and then you're actually been tricked in, and you're sort of being kettled at that point for like a good hour while you watch. They sort of broadcast on the screen all the real important invitees who are coming in, the celebrities who are coming in, being interviewed by Bowman, you know, on the red carpet. And you can sort of see this long trail of them almost like disappearing into the distance, and more cars pulling up all the time. And you're hearing them talk about how excited they are to be at this premiere, but you're also just so aware of how long this whole thing is going to take before they're in, before they sit down with you, Joe Public, and someone presses start on the film. I guess there's no going back at that point, but you just know how long you're in it for. And
absolutely, I think that the idea is that it's sold to you as a kind of evening out with the stars, and you know the idea that you would be sat there for an hour, 90 minutes pre-show with a little kind of, you know, Prosecco or something, and just sort of like looking around and feeling kind of starstruck. I think that is like.
With the dancing penguins and the fire
eaters.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, you know, you've got this stuff happening. The stuff is like being kind of live relayed in onto the screen. So you're kind of, you know, you're being kept engaged, I guess, if you're into it. But
I've been in some of these that have been sort of openly mutinous at the end of this period. Like I took my two very young children to see Frozen 2. By the way, should we just say at this point that the only reason we get invited to these things is because we're sort of low-flying journalists who are around the edges of film, and they just have a few tickets around the edges, so they just every so often toss us a couple. There's no VIP status here. There's no sort of...
No.
So
we're not sitting next to like Lenny Henry or anything like that. You know, we're in the gods. But like, I must say, I do get like, I don't get invites to premieres, but I get like alerts for premieres. Like, so I know when they're going to be happening.
So you can go and get an autograph if you want.
And it's, well, so I can...
you can get on the Harris fencing.
So I can camp out to get my VHS copies signed. And yeah. Also, but also I can basically apply for a ticket if I wanted to go. And I think occasionally when a film hasn't screened for the press, I think we've tried to go to a premiere or two, or like maybe being able to get an early peek of something prior to a press screening. But like beyond that, I haven't really, you know, I've never been like, we request your presence at this.
that's an impressively professional reason to be going. I mean, I basically just every so often will get suckered into thinking, oh, it'll be glam, it'll be amazing. Like, you know, even though I know that isn't the truth and I've been burned many times, I keep going back. And this time, so they invited me to, they had a few, couple of spares for the Frozen 2 premiere, which was which is, you know, my daughter's a bit big into the Frozen franchise, and my son's too young to know any different, so we all clattered along. And I just assumed, you know, there's going to be a bunch of kids at this thing. You know, you look around the screening room and it's just like full of sort of parent celebs and parent influencers and just, you know, just a lot of kids. And they still did the Kettling thing. So we get in, the doors, you know, the doors bolt shut. And then, you know, Bowman's on the screen interviewing the real celebs for a good hour. And it was toasty. And there, by the end of that hour, I'm telling you, wow. You know, there was a little snackette on the arm of each seat. And it was something like a kind of goji berry and pecan kind of Nutribar. And that was it. And that was what we had to fight down the unrest of 100 under 6-year-olds.
That's an awful logistical error, I think, on somebody's. I hope somebody got fired for that.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't that long after that the president of Disney, you know, sort of stepped aside. So, you know, that might have trundled up the
Knows? Who knows? Did you send a strongly worded email?
Strongly worded tweet. There would have been some strong tweets coming out of that screening room, yes. I think.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I mean, I think this is probably as good a time as any to just sort of segue into the kind of, a sort of secondary discussion point that we should talk about is a premiere that we actually attended together, yes. Way back when, in the year 2000.
Yes.
When we were in like the, I mean, I'm shocked to actually remember that we were actually in the final year of school when we did this.
Yeah, I think we just had our A levels.
Yeah, so I don't know if you remember this, but maybe if you want to have a go at giving some like background as to how we scored the tickets and the film that we ended up seeing.
Yeah, so I've got like extremely vivid momentary memories from this day and then big blanks, and so I'm gonna do my best. But
so remind us where you were, because if you were working at this place, or you're doing work experience.
Yeah, I was doing work experience that summer, or maybe it was a kind of summer job or somewhere in the middle, with a film charity based near Leicester Square. And I think, as probably sometimes happens in the offices of film or film adjacent companies, someone said, I've got these premiere tickets, does anyone fancy them? And, you know, you mentioned it earlier to a couple of kids from Enfield, the idea of going to a premiere was just, you know, this was Valhalla. And I can imagine myself, you know, pretty quickly out of that office chair to go and claim them, or possibly no one claimed them. And I then sort of sheepishly approached and said, you know, I'll take them off your hands. Do you remember me getting in touch and saying, you know, Dave, I've got them. I've, you know, we're doing this. We're going.
Do you know what? My memory is that it was actually even more of a kind of drawn out thing, where it was less a kind of someone threw the tickets down and you nabbed them. But there was actually more of a kind of, you told me, oh, watch your backs. I might be able to like score us some tickets for this film premiere.
Yeah,
and
so I really I trailed it beforehand. I like really got the adrenaline pumping. Yeah,
and this was definitely before like text messages and stuff like that. So,
this was peak text. This was
text messages.
I think it's worth saying that this is summer 2000. So like this is a huge, you know, time for movies. I mean, this was like, you know, Gladiator, you know, was coming, American Psycho. There was just some really good stuff out there.
In fact, let's dial back just very quickly, because I think it's probably worth saying that, like, in our kind of experience of going to see event films together, we've had some pretty duff luck, I would say, because like the first sort of biggie that I think that we were both super excited about and that we had got advanced tickets for and we went on opening night was Phantom Menace.
And we both
really did not like that, and I seem to recall you were actually quite angry about it.
I was fuming, Dave.
I believe we saw that in the Finchley I don't think it was a view. The Finchley Warner Village is where we went.
Warner Village, yeah.
And then a couple of years after that,
we'd probably gone the full Frankie and Benny's beforehand. You know, the full,
yes, everything,
the full leisure centre experience.
Yeah, we were full retail park experience.
Yeah,
and then we had this premiere, and then after that, I remember we made a quite a big thing of going to see The Matrix Reloaded, the second we were both in university, and I'd come to visit you cross country
specially for
a weekend, and I hung out with all your friends, and all your friends were with you as well, and they were all excited to see it, and we even traveled out into a kind of, because I think tickets had been so hard to score because it was such a highly sought after film, that we actually ended up travelling into the suburbs to see it. So it was quite a big schlep to see the
suburban Sheffield to see The Matrix 2.
Exactly. We were all massively disappointed with that. So this sort of central fragment fits into a kind of a wider downward spiral of movie going companionship, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I also think it's worth saying that, you know, we were on different tracks, I think. So in summer 2000, you know, we're coming to the end of our school days. And I as I remember it, maybe you'll disagree, we'd had a kind of... We'd aged at different speeds in our taste for movies, if I can put it like that. You know, when we were 11 and 12 and 13, we just loved the same stuff. You know, there was just no question, you know, that perhaps accepting Malice, I don't remember it. You know, we agreed, you know, that what was A+, what was A, you know, we were on a level with each other. And then as I remember it, slowly over time, I was a child with a child's taste, and I just sort of stayed that way, you know, more or less into my 20s. And you just one night left school as a child with child's taste, and you just came back as a grown-up, and you suddenly liked sort of real films, and you knew how to sort of cope with and understand films that had subtitles and films that were made in other countries and that didn't have fight sequences in them, and that, you know, there was no obvious plot, and they, you know, they, and there was no sort of redemption at the end. And for a long time, I just I think I struggled with that a bit. You know, I think there was obviously the great schism of 1999. Do you remember, do you know what I'm talking about?
Are we talking about Buffalo 66?
No, we're talking about, God, I'd forgotten that schism. I'm talking about the great Rosetta versus American Pie debate, where we had a really sour, borderline violent disagreement about what the best film of 1999 was. And you know, just quickly, you thought it was this very moving, powerful Belgian kitchen sink drama called Rosetta, and I thought it was American Pie starring Jason Biggs.
I'm coming off really badly here.
Do you think? I'm trying to pay you a compliment here. You were on a path towards a life as a film critic. I mean, I was just sort of my tastes were pretty flat, I would say.
But you know, I think sort of looking back now, I think, you know, I definitely can see the relative. I have more of a kind of idea of the sort of relativity of that, of connecting those films. And you know, maybe it was naive for us to be arguing over which how American Pie is superior to, because I think, you know, in its own way, and I'm sure if you're sort of looking at it from a historical angle, that, you know, each have their relative merits.
Although I was thinking about American Pie, and I'm just not sure it would bear much scrutiny, you know, through the eyes of 2020. I mean, the central scene, comedic scene, is more or less a sort of episode of revenge porn. I mean, it's, yes, you know, it's I don't even know if you could screen that film these days. It hasn't aged well at all. I haven't checked out Rosetta. Maybe that has done better. I would guess probably it has.
It's pretty good still. I maybe wouldn't like go so far as to say it was like my favorite film of 1999 anymore, but you put me on the spot a bit there, so I'd have to go back and actually explore that further.
The only reason I'm bringing it up is that, just, you know, that summer we were at a kind of crossroads. We were about to go to different universities. We'd had this amazing friendship and this amazing history of like a kind of shared love of films, but then we'd also had our bumpy moments in the road. And I would have been thinking something along the lines of, you know, this is it. We're going to a premiere. This is going to be, you know, the night of our lives, and this is going to sort of paper over all those cracks.
But just to let you know as well, is even though I was maybe interested in, you know, starting to get interested in like foreign language films, indie films, and all that kind of stuff, I was like sincerely excited about going to see this film premiere.
Yeah, me too.
Like, you know, there was no like oh, let's do it as a kind of ironic gesture. It was like, you know, oh God, we're going to a film premiere, this is big, you know. Like,
I remember thinking, it just doesn't matter what the film's like, because, you know, that's not the point here. This is about the flamethrowers and the, you know, and the chorus girls. It's just, yeah.
So do you want to name that film?
Oh yeah. So I had landed us tickets for the Flintstones prequel, the Flintstones Viva Rock Vegas. As I remember it, you didn't think twice. You were in. You wanted to come see it. I was definitely in. We agreed to meet in Leicester Square sort of a couple hours early, just to sort of take it all in.
Mm-hmm. So do you remember the kind of the stuff that happened before the film?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm aware that's partly why you want to talk about it. I've got patchy memories of it. I wonder how much I've sort of blocked out. But
do you want me to give my, because I was more of a sort of bystander in the whole, you know, the whole sort of scene.
Yeah.
So maybe I could sort of give my recollection, and you can, you know, if you have any kind of commentary you want to add. So we met in Leicester Square, you know, right there in the middle. I seem to recall this was before. I think it was sort of like just on the edges of the little kind of garden thing. I'm trying to even remember if there was a garden there.
Yeah, there was. It looks different now, but there was this kind of scraggy sort of bush-lined garden that was a mixture of tourists, homeless, people eating takeaway McDonald's. You know, it was pretty unkempt, you know, and it wasn't... No, I mean, nothing about... I sort of struggle to picture it now, Leicester Square, but, like, nothing about Leicester Square is or was glamorous, but this was when it was really
it's kind of it was, you know, maybe to use that kind of term, it was more kind of colourful back then, but like
it was colourful.
It's now completely kind of dead-eyed there, but you know, it's certainly more kind of, you know, family friendly, you know, it's all about the M&M store and Lego store.
Did they have M&M World in the year 2000?
No, that was much later.
Pre-M&M. I mean, that sets the scene perfectly, really. You know, this was a dystopia compared to now. There was no M&M World.
This was the pre-M&M World cinema that we are dealing with now. So, hopefully we'll get like a listener emailing in to set us straight on that, if it was actually there in 2000. So
we'd want receipts though to prove it.
Exactly. I remember that I can't remember the exact way it happened, but you'd met me and you'd come straight from somewhere, because you had a big rucksack with you.
Yeah, I'd probably come from the job that had given me the tickets.
Yeah. It must, yeah. So, I was waiting for you in Leicester Square, and I don't know if you had, I can't remember if we had phones, because I remember like we'd agreed to meet at a specific point, at a specific moment, and a specific time, and you were running late, and I was sort of just waiting for you, and then after about like 40 minutes. You kind of came sort of stomping up in a bit of a rage, and what had transpired is that you'd been kind of swizzed by a bloke who was
a con man, a grifter,
who'd clocked you and decided to take you for a bit of a ride.
He'd spotted an easy mark. I want to say I was distracted by the excitement of seeing Viva Rock Vegas, which was, partially true. But he'd also just spotted a mark. I mean, I was a know-nothing suburban kid standing outside a movie premiere with my backpack.
I actually suspect, thinking back now, that, you know, these guys probably knew that there was going to be a big premiere happening, and that would be their kind of like, this is kind of prime time
for us. They planned it? I mean, that makes me feel slightly better, actually, if it was premeditated.
Yeah.
Or if there was like a network, if there were like meetings beforehand, and they just like pinpointed the night of the Viva Rock Vegas premiere as like, that was going to be jackpot time.
I don't see why not, but like, it was the thing where you he says, "Oh, have you got like two tens for a 20 or two fives for a 10?" And you help him out, and he's like holding your two fives and your tens, like, "Oh, have you got a 20 for this 10 and two fives?" And you're like, "Oh, yeah, here you go." And
then in some ways, it was your classic tens and two tens for a 20 scam. Con, but I also want to say there were original elements to it that might have influenced me going along with it. I mean, did you get eyes on this guy? Because in my memory, he was a kind of like Dennis Waterman in Minder kind of figure, like kind of like, you know, brown leather jacket, sort of maybe like acne scarred, kind of quite just like a real like sort of gimlet eyed chancer. You know, he had a vibe. Did you ever see him?
I don't recall seeing him, but I remember you trying to like explain it to me afterwards and not understanding it.
Yeah.
What had happened.
Well, and because it was a complex three-dimensional scam.
Yeah. But also another thing to remember is like at that age, dropping 20 quid was massive. Dropping like 30 quid or 40 quid was absolutely like, you know, that was devastating.
That was huge. Three CDs at our price. That was, you know, that was
a lot.
And I wasn't sure how much you had witnessed of the opening fate of Act One of The Grift, but if we're entirely relying on my memory, basically what happened was I got there really early, probably just excited and standing there with my backpack on, and obviously just looked like someone who maybe had two tens or could swap for a 20. And so Dennis Waterman from Minder kind of came up, or this, you know, the comment
looked like
came.
A tout.
Yeah, maybe just the kind of friendly, you know, like in London. Yeah. And I think I probably imagine myself as like someone who had grown up in London, even though, you know, we did and we didn't, because, you know, we were a 40-minute tube ride north, and, you know, I didn't feel I knew London particularly well then. But, you know, we were doing our A-levels. I think I probably had an idea of myself as, you know, a little bit grown up. I mean, I was extremely young for that age, but... And so he said, he gave me the, you know, can you swap this note for this note, the introductory scam. But then there was this really kind of involved and complex kind of adventure journey phase where it didn't all play out just in front of the Viva Rock Vegas premiere. It sort of took in all these parts of Leicester Square. And so he was like, we got halfway through the transaction. He was like, oh, you know, I've just remembered I've got to get half of this from the cafe under Capitol Records or some, you know, or Yates is over there. And so we kind of, I had to follow him, and I just got this image of him like looking over his shoulder. And
so he was basically trying to escape.
No. See, this is what was the genius part of The Grift, was that he was playing it so slow, and in a way that I now don't understand, because he could have just blink and gone. I mean, what am I going to do? I'm like, you know, I'm going to a premiere. I'm not chasing him for this, however hard it would have been to lose that money. But he kind of kept me on quite a close reel. And so we were always going together on this like adventure around Leicester Square. So we went to the first place, and he had to like go in and speak to the bar manager of the Capitol Records kind of cafe. And then we went in together. It was like we were sort of doing this together. And then like, and he'd be just like, one minute. And then he would chat someone there. And then it's like, oh, you know, there'd be an exchange of coins, or, you know, there was definitely like money changing hands in each of these stops. And then we sort of go on to TGI Fridays or some pub that was there.
This sounds like a really involved like network of people who were all basically enabling him.
I think it was, you know, that opening scene of Mission Impossible where you realise that sort of everyone is in on the double cross.
And you're Ethan Hunt, basically.
I was Ethan Hunt. You were Emilio Estevez. Yeah. No, you were. No, because you survived. So you were.
No, I'm
you
Emmanuel Barrett.
You were Emmanuel Barrett. and this guy's, you know, John Voight or someone. And. And so he leads me in my memory, and I hope it's all I've got to go on, Dave, but is my memory. In my memory, it even takes in the Trocadero, which was like, we're still together. We're still on this journey to like, you know, sort of, I'm not even going to make money out of this. I'm just getting my money back. Okay. And we're a good 20 minutes in by now. You know, I mean, this is the first time I've thought about it for 2 decades. So,
and I'm just waiting in Leicester Square, looking at my watch, thinking I'm literally not leaving because I'm about to go and see Viva Rock Vegas. And like wild horses couldn't drag me away from this premiere. But because let me just sort of fast forward a tiny bit, because like by the time you actually did arrive back and you kind of stomped towards me,
he'd vanished just to you know, spoil the end of it. I mean, he eventually, after 6 or 7 stages, did his usual like chatting to the manager, or, you know, but he just sort of went slightly out of sight, and that was it. And I was, you know, that, you know, then 20 minutes in, the penny dropped.
Yes. And then you kind of stormed up to me, and then and your reaction was, I was like, what? I didn't know what had happened. So that you came up to me, and your reaction was, you took your backpack off and you slammed it on the floor, and then what you'd actually done is you actually had a very expensive portable mini disc player in the front of your rucksack, which you like literally smashed to pieces. So your losses from that kind of pre-Rock Vegas sort of, you know, advanced section. We're into the hundreds, I think.
Yeah, it was my 80th birthday present. It was a lovely little mini disc player. It was so little that you had to kind of attach an external plastic AA battery holder to have any power in it. They made it so small it couldn't power itself. But
It well. I was very jealous of it because I had a mini disc player too, and it was really chunky. This is definitely kind of nice era specific color. Yeah. So anyway. We were both fumed. I was kind of, you were obviously livid. I was actually pretty scared of your how livid you were, and thinking, should we be going to see this film? But I think
we relented
anyway. And yeah. the sort of the little spark that we got from walking the red carpet was maybe made us forget it a little while, but then we did the. You know, we had to go through all the kind of preamble and sat in there at the Kettling, and you know, we were in the Empire Leicester Square for you know, a fairly long time before things were kicking off, which allowed us to kind of rake over what had happened and get even more angry about the situation.
Had I, in your memory of it, had I fully computed just how much worse, exponentially worse, I'd made it through my temper, through my sort of shame and outrage about the whole thing? But if I'd just taken the loss of the money... my beautiful mini disc.
No. But because I think at that age, it was so much more significant and valuable. And like, I think there was a kind of rite of passage element as well, because it's like, not only did you have this, were you the victim of this scam, but you it was a kind of moment of discovery where you kind of, you know, you experienced firsthand the evil in the world. You know,
London had bitten back.
Yeah, exactly. It's like David Lynch. It's like, you know, you see the kind of white picket fence and you know, toothy grins and smiles and you know, but actually underneath it is a cesspool of hate and murder. You know, so like,
I want to test your memory. Do you remember what they were wearing and how they were outfitted? How they'd outfitted the extras who were sort of attending the premiere. Do you remember what they were wearing?
I don't recall, no. I think I was too scared of your kind of mental state at the time. Or my only memory is that we were sat behind Vanessa Feltz.
Oh, yeah. So pre-Feltz, just before we got to Feltz, we had to go past these kind of, I guess, like bodyguards or bouncers or kind of just like ripped men. Like in rows of them, who were all wearing plunging leopard skin sort of, I guess, like smocks or muumuus or something, and all holding giant white plastic bones, because it was a Flintstones film. It was mise-en-scène to create
with like metal baseball bats hidden inside, probably.
Because I think they were doubling as the guys who were there to sort of, you know, check you're not. You haven't secretly brought in a sharp digicam to film the whole thing. And they were trying to encourage people to like nibble the bone and like take pictures with the bone and like maybe with the, you know, with these guys and just sort of get into the Flintstones vibe of the thing. So to go from, you know, really for me, like, you know, your first like adult experience of deception and loss and sort of monetary loss into, you know, within seconds into this kind of lobby where, you know, suntan men are trying to get you to nibble a baseball bat sized white bone was, you know, I mean, it was up there with the more surreal moments of my life.
That's got to be a real kind of mind mind warp. I want to say something rude there, but I'm not going to.
Jim Davidson was there as well. Do you remember that?
Yeah. And Steps.
Steps were there.
Yeah.
Of course they were. You didn't get many premieres, I would guess, in summer 2000 that Steps weren't at. But I'm glad we clocked up Steps as well.
So, and I'm sure there were probably, because this was like, you know, at the height of Big Brother as well. So I'm sure there were a couple of Big Brother people.
No, you know what? I was thinking this. This was the innocent days before Big Brother started. So we were just, this was the end of like popular culture really as we like knew it. This was like the end of the 90s. You know, Big Brother was just about to start. And there was a sort of certain type of celeb there that I now think of as quite innocently kind of pre-reality, like a GMTV presenter and, you know, Jim Davison and his entire family. I want to say Melinda Messenger was there. It was that kind of, you know what yeah. I mean? It was definitely a Messenger-ish event.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We didn't last long in the film. I think a mixture of the film's low quality and and the kind of general atmosphere and kind of residual feelings that had maybe boiled up, perhaps aided by the low quality of the film, or catalyzed further, led us to walk out about 30 minutes into the film. I mean, I actually today rewatched I watched the film because I haven't actually officially seen it, because we walked out after 30 minutes. So.
Did you want to know what happened? Was it like
I wanted to watch the film as a kind of deep research thing and just to pinpoint the moment that we left. And the kind of very basic plot is it's you know, you're with Fred and Barney, and it's before they'd married Wilma and Betty, and weirdly, Alan Cumming plays an alien, a little mini alien who is sent to Earth to sort of examine their mating rituals. So you're getting Fred and Wilma are getting together, and you've also got Alan Cumming, who only Fred and Barney can see as well, which is a nice little twist.
Wait, why do they go to Rock Vegas? Why is there a Rock Vegas?
So Wilma is actually heir to a huge fortune, and there is a kind of chiseler guy who wants to get married to her so he can buy a casino there. Or he owns a casino, but he's massively in hock to some loan sharks. And so he needs to marry Wilma to be able to like keep his casino afloat. So he invites her and Fred and Barney and Betty for like a weekend there. And
Fred, that sounds suspiciously like Vegas was offering some sort of tax break to make movies. Why?
Well, there's no. I mean, it's not very. You know, there's no actual. You know, beyond the sort of thing that like like an 8-year-old would know about Vegas. There's no actual like. You know, literal connection to Las Vegas. So it's like it's a depiction of the kind of gambling industry with the most kind of broad brush strokes, and you know, using lots of cliches and whatnot. But it's really bad film. It's one of those interesting films where it was like in that age of like early CGI, but mixed with like prosthetics. So for me, that makes it a little bit more interesting, because there's at least some kind of visible artistry there. But although one of the things that is really kind of jarring about the film is that you can see everything is like made of fiberglass. So that kind of takes you out of the fact that you're meant to be in, you know, the prehistoric era.
When we were at school, we were obviously obsessed with Johnny Vaughan's film reviews. And he used to give, do you remember this? He used to give like films, 1 out of 5 dogs or 2 out of 5 yes. dogs. Was that
yeah, yeah.
What would you give? How many dogs out of 5 would you give Beaver Rock Vegas?
I would say it was like a 1.5 dogs, because I think it's a really terrible film, made purely for like cynical money grabbing means. I like some of the kind of production design on it, and it looks like a relic. It looks like a film from 2000, and I think that's a good sign. It's got a kind of historical value to it. But like one of the reasons they did make it is because the original with John Goodman and Rick Moranis, they made for like 40 million, and it yielded like 300 million profits. So it was a huge, huge success. And this one they made for 80 million, and it made 40 million. So they lost 40 million on it. So it was a huge flop. Interesting bit of trivia as well is that not only did it get nominated for a lot of Razzie Awards. Are you familiar with the Razzies?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Did it win?
I don't think it won any, but it got nominated for a whole clutch. But then it also got nominated, and this is quite a rare thing, for another film awards called the Stinkers, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a kind of Razzie's a lesser. It's like the if the Razzies are the Oscars, this it would be like the stinkers are the kind of Golden Globes.
Yeah, this is the Screen Actors Guild Awards.
Exactly. So like this, so it got nominated for a load of stinkers as well, and deserved, if you ask me. Alan Cumming's especially. I mean, Alan Cumming's career. I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but you know, he did this like a year after he was in Eyes Wide Shut, which is like, you know, doesn't even bear thinking about, really. Going from like Kubrick to Viva Rock Vegas.
To Rock Vegas. You know, so did Cummings...
Such is the life of a character actor.
Did Cummings come to the premiere? Was he there?
I suspect he was, but I don't remember. Again, I think we were so in our little zone of like, what the hell's just happened, that we weren't really taking account of that. So, you know, this was... I'm gonna bring the chat to a close now, because we're kind of nudging close to an hour. So, but yeah, this was the story of our trip to see Viva Rock Vegas, and it hopefully gave some wider insight into the world, into the strange world of movie premieres. Tom Lamont, thank you so much for giving me some time to chat to you about this.
Thanks, man.
You can get in touch with us at Truth and Movies on Twitter and truthandmovies@tcolondon.com via email if you have any comments or questions. As that, we've got a little page on our website as well. And again, thanks to Tom. And this has been a 7Digital production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.